You have to get some recompense. I just want to, again, thank Senator Hagel. Secretary Armitage said at lunch that he was glad. I think he was coming before you and not after you. He was frightened. He'd seen you this morning and said he was, and we can well see why. But
wait a minute, Armitage was frightened of me. You all saw Armitage.
Yes. Well, he hurt his finger. He had a bandage on his finger, so I felt he wasn't going to do so well. But it really was. It really lived up to what we thought. And when, as I said earlier, if you would go through the number of committees that the senator serves on, and on which I've heard over the last 6 years, whenever you ask anybody in the Senate who to go to, whether it has something to do with foreign relations or energy or banking or international trade, they all say Senator Hagel. So I'm just hoping that maybe next time he comes, he won't be the ranking member, he'll be the chairman. But it's not a political rally, so we won't get into that. But he's agreed to stay on now. We'll have a panel with Sandy, and I think we could take questions for both of them. Is that okay? Okay, that's sure. So there are microphones, so all I'll do is just point out to people, and you can identify who you'd like your question, or we'll just address it to them. The young lady there?
I'm Dr. Marianne Kuzumanala from Catholic University, and I have two questions for Mr. Berger. The first is the private sector. You talk about the need for multilateral cooperation. The administration you work for did a lot to extend cooperation with the private sector for critical infrastructure protection and other things. That's one area we really haven't discussed today, the role of the private sector in the war on terrorism. So I wonder if you could address that. Secondly, as a member of the National Security Council during your term there, you were in favor of the bombings of Afghanistan and Sudan for the al-Qaeda camps there, came under intense criticism for that decision at that point. Now many of those same critics are arguing that wasn't enough. I wonder if you could talk about the difficulties when the administration, any administration, whatever political party, wants to lead, and that outstrips public and congressional support.
Sandy? That's an easy, easy questions.
On critical infrastructure, I agree with you. It is central. We, in 1995, commissioned the first national plan on critical infrastructure, as you know. This is our airports, our transportation, our cybersecurity, set up private-public groups to try to work together to make these systems more secure. That effort has greatly intensified since 9/11. It's now run by our former coordinator for terrorism, Richard Clark. My sense is that the private sector was wary of this before 9/11, didn't particularly want to share too much information with government on sensitive questions about its oil pipelines, but now I think feels understands the compelling need for that. I certainly agree with you. It's a central priority. Use of force in Afghanistan, Sudan in 98. After the bombing of the African embassies in 98, 12 Americans were killed and a large number of Africans. For the first time, the intelligence community was able to say to us, this was al-Qaeda, bin Laden. We soon thereafter learned that there would be a large gathering of al-Qaeda operatives at a particular camp in Khost. We attacked that camp. We also attacked a facility in Sudan. I won't get into that discussion ad nauseum. It was the right thing to do. It was not a toothpaste factory. It was associated with chemical weapons. And from that point on, really tried very hard to get bin Laden. It was extraordinarily difficult. We were not at war with Afghanistan at that point. We were not inside Afghanistan. And he's obviously proven to be an elusive target even since 9/11. But with respect to your fundamental question about public attitudes and use of force more generically, You ultimately decide in these situations that you do what is right because you're going to get blasted no matter what. It's somewhat liberating when you come to that conclusion, whether it's Haiti or the Balkans, or I'm sure President Bush has had the same experience. Since you're either going to be criticized as doing too little or too much, you might as well focus on what you think is right and let the politics take care of themselves. Thank you. Aaron Fishbone, American University. During the Mideast breakout session, the panelists expressed a fear or expressed the comment that after a repressive regime is overthrown, that there's often a period of in which vendettas are carried out because of, by the people who are repressed. How do you manage? You both seem to support regime change in Iraq. So how would it be managed to order to prevent vendettas from being carried out, and more importantly, from being done in a way that our American and hopefully UN troops were not used as law enforcement officers in those countries?
Senator?
I'll begin. What you have described is one dynamic of the reality that you face when you undertake a hostile action, and you prepare as best you can for the reality of dealing with it. Now, how do you do that? There's no perfect way, but certainly in my remarks, I talked a little bit about commitment, sustaining commitment to not just remove a government from office, but a question I have been asking for the last couple of months in regard to Iraq, what comes then? What comes next? Do you further destabilize not only Iraq, but the entire Middle East? Because you know these vendettas and all that will follow will certainly be a possibility if there is not a sustained and real and strong and military and civilian effort there on the ground to deal with that as that opens up. I mean, you all are aware of what happened in Afghanistan a few hours ago. That is a perfect example of what happens. That means sufficient force in place, and I would say many in my party, the Republican Party, find it very difficult to even utter the phrase nation building. I have to remind some of my colleagues that's exactly what we're doing in Afghanistan. You might feel better if you rename it, but that's the kind of thing that the questioner brings out that you have to think through before you you put the F-16s in the air and you go after your target, because there are consequences. Something happens, something follows, and you better think it through. It will be imperfect. That's something we all accept, but that's why you need allies. You need coalitions. You need force. You need some structure. You need to think through the alternatives. Who is there to govern? Question is, for example, Jim Webb brought this case up yesterday in the Washington Post. Does America want to, should we, make a commitment to be in Iraq? He said 30 to 50 years. That may be more than required, but let's say 20 years, say 10 years. Do we want to have Americans running Baghdad with troops in Iraq? So those are questions that need to be thought through, answered as best you can, but you can't find a solution to answer your question unless you are willing to take on the heavy burden and commitment to stay there as long as it takes to help fix the problem. And again, you can't do it alone.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Chuck Cogan, Kennedy School. This is a question for Mr. Berger, but the senator might want to make a contribution too. At the beginning of your talk, you spoke of a fierce and focused operation in Afghanistan in contrast to an indiscriminate activity which might lead to great unrest in the Islamic world. I think this is reflective of the fact that our position psychologically vis-a-vis Iraq is very weak. And this goes back to the end of the war, when we didn't want to put American troops into Baghdad, which I think was a wise decision. You don't put Western troops into an Arab city numbering in the millions. And instead, we imposed a regime of the international community on a gangster government, and it hasn't worked. It was a question, and I'm quoting the words of Charles Delfer, the former deputy chief of UNSCOM. It was a question of a coercive disarmament activity led by people who were not part of an occupation force. This is very difficult.
Sorry, do you have a question? Yeah, go ahead, because we have so little time because they have to leave. So if you have a question, ask it.
All right, I'll ask the question. What do we do from here, since our position is so weak? The only answer seemed to be to go multilateral with the Congress and with our allies, as Senator Hagel indicated.
Thank you.
Well, I believe that I agree with what Senator Hagel has said, that we need to, as a first step, as Secretary Powell has said, to go back, to go to the United Nations, to seek anytime, any place, anywhere inspection regime, with the implicit understanding that if that is either not accepted or accepted and then tampered with and eluded by Saddam Hussein, we're in a very different situation. I think that's an essential predicate to building the kind of international support that I think is necessary to undertake an operation in Iraq that would wind up with that region being more stable rather than less stable.
Senator, do you have a comment on that?
I think Sandy hit right, and I've already essentially commented on it. Thank you.
Yes?
My name is Mohammed Wahbi. I'm a political columnist and the bureau chief of the Cairo-based magazine of Al Musawwar. Having heard both Senator Hagel and Mr. Sandberger, I cannot resist but prefacing my question by one sentence only. What a world of difference it will make to have an administration which has both of you.
The beginning of something here.
Now the question. I would like to ask about your assessment.
Take note.
About the assessment of both of you. How the situation is developing in the United States. Is it now moving towards more understanding of the necessity, if not the inevitability, of acting multilaterally, or are we having a fixed situation that we're still, those who are for unilateralism, is still having a sway in informing the policies of this country?
Well, I think that question is unresolved as we sit here on September 5th. I think that we have had a fair amount of go-it-alone-ism, not just on the war on terrorism, but across a number of issues that I talked about in my remarks. And I think that we certainly were building up a head of steam on Iraq that sounded an awful lot like our way or the highway. I hope President Bush's meeting with the congressional leaders yesterday and his suggestion and their suggestions of administration officials of looking at going back to the UN suggests a recognition that going alone in Iraq is an extraordinarily costly and dangerous proposition. There may be circumstances at some time in the future where that is unavoidable. I would not rule that out. I don't think those circumstances exist today to go it alone. So I think we're in a kind of pivotal moment here because Iraq will be in some ways a bit of, not a bit, will be a real template in which we decide whether in fact in this complicated world we need partners or whether or not we believe that we are powerful enough to do to go it alone. And I hope that we are moving in a collective direction.
I think, Senator, you talked about it in your speech. Do you want to add anything to that? Because, I mean, you really said it.
I did address it, but I would just add this. I cannot speak for the Bush administration. I can't speak for any senator, member of Congress. But it is my sense that President Bush has a very clear sense of what we're talking about here. And certainly Secretary Powell does. And I think what we saw yesterday with the president's meeting with the congressional leadership and laying out a process that he spoke rather clearly about, coming to the Congress, having all of his appropriate administration officials testify, clearly defining what the policy is, listening, conferring, answering the tough questions, on parallel tracks, talking directly to the leaders of the other permanent United Nations Security Council members, Prime Minister Blair being at Camp David this weekend, speaking before the General Assembly of the United Nations. That all says to me that this president understands what we're talking about here, and I think that's the right way to approach it, and I think our allies and the people of the world should take some comfort in that approach. Now, how it ends up, I don't know. We will most likely, before the Congress goes home for the elections, be asked to vote on a resolution. We don't know what kind of resolution. We don't know the wording of that resolution. But I think every member of Congress is preparing himself or herself for the eventuality over the next few weeks, not just the debate, but most likely a vote on a resolution.
Thank you. We have time for just two more questions because we have to move on about the poor. I'm sure that the vote will probably come at some point, but go ahead.
My name is Bill Mikhail. I'm from the University of Maryland. I have a question to the two speakers. However, I would appreciate if Ambassador Kempelman comment. Could have the Clinton administration or the Bush administration prevented September 11 from happening? Thanks.
Senator?
I'll be quite brief. My answer, which I give often, Sandy, is I don't know. But no, I don't know how in the world the Clinton administration, the Bush administration, could have been in a position to stop what happened. That does not mean that we excuse gaps and breakdowns, which we now know were there in intelligence and security and everywhere. But the reality is that we are a nation of 280 million mobile, open, transparent, free people in the most open, transparent society probably in the history of man. If terrorists wish to inflict some harm, damage, strike, and if they are intent upon doing that, it is very, very difficult to be able to guard every border, every installation, and every airport, and every citizen. Now, must we do better? Absolutely. And I think we are all well aware of the activity that was put in motion on that day. And continues to this day. We're debating today a new department of the federal government called Homeland Security to deal with this, to better equip ourselves to deal with it. But I don't think, again, I speak only for myself, that anyone can cast blame on any administration or any individual or any institution for not being able to stop this. Again, it doesn't excuse a lot of the gaps, but we will, as we have been over the last year, find out more and more not only what happened and why, but what needs to be fixed, how to fix it, and that's a continuing process. At the same time, last point I'd make is balance the Constitution and the liberties that are guaranteed in that Constitution with the requirements of security, of securing. The safety of our people. That, as you know, has been a very significant debate over the last year. Immigration policy, holding people without charging them, and many other issues. So we must find a center of gravity and an equilibrium that we've never had to find before in the history of this country.
Yes?
John Salzberg with the United Nations Association. Under the UN Economic Sanctions Program against Iraq, UNICEF has estimated that 500,000 children have died as a consequence of these sanctions, and a response that this is Saddam Hussein's misuse of funds is not adequate. The United States, as a member of the, a permanent member of the UN Security Council, has put a hold on many requests for water purification and sanitation projects for Iraq. And this is the principal cause of the death of children. How does this advance U.S. security, and what are the implications morally for this position?
Well, I don't totally agree with your analysis. Let's remember that at the end of the war, 91, 92, soon thereafter, the United States proposed a oil for food program, that is, enabling Saddam Hussein to sell very substantial amounts of his oil to be used for essentially necessities for his people. He turned that program down for 5 years. 5 years. Then he accepted the program, diverted large amounts of money. But I think that we all realized in 98, 99 that we needed a better, more streamlined program that focused more intensely on the things we didn't want him to get, not the things that we wanted his people to get, and the smart sanctions, so to speak, initiative of the Powell administration, of Powell State Department, started in the Clinton administration, the idea of essentially enabling him to sell as much oil as he wants, so long as it's for, not for military and other prohibited weapons. There are dual-use items that always cause concerns. I think a lot of the questions of American holds and American on contracts has been streamlined. But I don't think the fundamental reason why the people of Iraq are suffering today is the sanctions. I think they're Saddam Hussein, and I think it's a little bit it's an important question, but it I think unfairly puts the burden on the international community for the suffering of the Iraqi people.
Sorry, first, Senator, I'm sure you just agree with that. Well. Thank you. I mean, all three of you. I mean, you have a very, it seems to be a continuum of extremely impressive three people sitting, beginning with Max Kampelman, who has been there since every major event in the last, I won't say how many years, Max, but it's an honor that you were up here and helping with it. What? 1776? 1776, exactly. I thought it was 1789. And Sandy, who we all have known, who spoke at our conference 2 years ago, the U.S. when we had the passing of the baton to Condi Rice. It seems like it seems like 100 years ago, probably. But
for her, for sure.
And it's rather nice because in those days there was no way you could stay over the half hour that was allotted to come here. So we're honored. And, Senator, we're just glad there wasn't a vote, and thank you for joining us. And now, Chet, do you want to make some final comments, our chairman, for the session, and we'll just thank you.